Chapter 1. Strange shadows rippled before my uncaring gaze, undulating across my vision like colorful phantoms from some remote, pleasant world. The sun-dappled water lay tranquil inches from my face. Gently I inserted my arm below the surface, watching the lazy little waves which the motion caused. Squint-eyed I peered into the depths below. Yes, that big old stone, that is where he lived, and he was coming out to greet me. Idly I let my fingers trail along the sides of the now motionless fish, motionless save for the easy movement of the fins as he kept station by my fingers. He and I were old friends. Often I would come and drop food into the water for him before caressing his body. We had the complete understanding which comes only to those who have no fear of each other. At that time I did not even know that fish were edible. Buddhists do not take life or inflict suffering on others. I took a deep breath and pushed my face below the surface, anxious to peer more closely into another world. Here I felt like a god gazing down at a very different form of life. Tall fronds waved faintly in some unseen current, sturdy water growths stood erect like the giant trees of some forest. A sandy streak meandered along like a mindless serpent, and was fringed with a pale green plant looking for all the world like a well-kept lawn. Tiny little fish, multicolored and with big heads, flashed and darted among the plants in their continual search for food and fun. A huge water snail laboriously lowered itself down the side of a great gray rock so that it could do its task of cleaning the sand. But my lungs were bursting, the hot noonday sun was scorching the back of my neck, and the rough stones of the foreshore were digging into my flesh. With a last look round, I rose to my knees and thankfully breathed deep of the scented air. Here, in my world, things were very different from the placid world which I had been studying. Here there was bustle, turmoil, and much scurrying about. Staggering a little from a healing wound in my left leg, I stood and rested with my back against a favorite old tree and looked about me. The Norbulinga was a blaze of color, the vivid green of the willows, the scarlet and gold of the island temple, and the deep, deep blue of the sky emphasized by the pure white of the fleecy clouds which came racing over the mountains from India. The calm waters of the lake reflected and exaggerated the colors and lent an air of unreality when a vagrant breeze roiled the water and caused the picture to sway and blur. All here was peaceful, quiet, yet just beyond the wall, as I could see, conditions were very different. Russet-robed monks strode about carrying piles of clothes to be washed. Others squatted by the side of the sparkling stream and twisted and turned the clothes so that they should be well soaked. Shaven heads gleamed in the sunlight and, as the day progressed, gradually became sun-reddened. Small acolytes, newly joined to the lamasery, leapt about in a frenzy of excitement as they pounded their robes with big smooth stones that they should look older, more worn, and so give the impression that the wearer had been an acolyte longer. Occasionally the sun would reflect bright shafts of light from the golden robes of some August lama journeying between the Potala and the Pagokling. Most of them were men of staid appearance, men who had grown old in temple service. Others, a very few, were young men indeed, some of them being recognized incarnations, while others had progressed and advanced on their own merit. Striding about, looking very alert and fierce, were the proctors, large men from the province of Kham, men charged with the task of maintaining discipline. Erect and bulky, they carried huge staves as a sign of their office. No intellectuals, these, but men of brawn and integrity, and chosen for that alone. One came close and glowered inquiringly at me. Belatedly recognizing me, he strode off in search for offenders worthy of his attention. Behind me the towering bulk of the Potala, the home of the god, skywards, one of the more glorious works of man. The multi-hued rock glowed gently and sent vari-hued reflections skittering across the placid waters. By a trick of the shifting light, the carved and colored figures at the base seemed imbued with life, causing them to sway and move like a group of people in animated discussion. Great shafts of yellow light, reflected from the golden tombs on the Potala roof, sped off and formed vivid splashes on the darker mountain recesses. A sudden thunk and the creak of bending wood caused me to turn to this new source of attraction. An ancient bird, gray and molting, older than the oldest acolyte, had alighted on the tree behind me. Eyeing me with remarkably beady eyes, it said "Kruk," and suddenly shuffled so that its back was towards me. It stretched to full length and violently flapped its wings while expelling an unwanted gift in my direction with astonishing force and precision. Only by a desperate jump aside did I escape being a target. The bird shuffled round to face me again and said "Kruk, Kruk," before dismissing me from its attention in favor of the greater interest elsewhere. On the gentle breeze came the first faint sounds of an approaching group of traders from India. The lowing of yaks as they protested at their drovers' attempts to hurry them. The asthmatic creak and wheeze of old, dry leather harness, the plodding shuffle of many feet and the musical tinkle of small pebbles being jostled aside by the caravan. Soon I could see the lumbering beasts, piled high with exotic bundles. Great horns tossing above shaggy eyebrows, the rise and fall as the huge animals stumped along with their slow, untiring gait. The traders, some with turbans, some with old fur hats, others with battered felt headgear. "Arms, arms for the love of God," cried the beggars. "Ah," they shouted as the traders moved on unfeelingly, "your mother is a cow who mated with a boar, your seed is the seed of Shiv, your sisters are sold in the marketplace." Strange odors came to twitch at my nostrils, making me draw in a deep breath, and then sneeze heartily. Scents from the heart of India, bricks of tea from China, ancient dust being shaken from the yak-borne bales, all were wafted my way. Into the distance faded the sound of the yak bells, the loud talk of the traders, and the imprecations of the beggars. Soon the ladies of Lhasa would have wealthy callers at their doors. Soon the shopkeepers would be haggling over prices demanded by the traders, raised eyebrows and higher raised voices at the inexplicably increased prices. Soon I would have to be going back to the Potala. My attention wandered. Idly I watched the monks at their ablutions, two of them ready to come to blows at the threat of thrown water from one. Rapidly the proctors moved in, a flurry of motion, and two chastened monks were marched off, each in the iron grip of guardians of the peace. But what was that? I let my gaze search the bushes. Two tiny glittering eyes looked anxiously at me from near ground level. Two small grey eyes were inclined intently in my direction. A minute body was crouched ready to rush should I make a false move. A little grey mouse was pondering on the possibility of passing between me and the lake on its way home. As I looked, he darted forward, all the time keeping his gaze on me. His care was misplaced, not looking where he was going. He charged headlong into a fallen branch and with a shrill squeak of terror leapt a foot in the air. He jumped badly, jumped too far to the side. As he came down he missed his footing and fell into the lake. The poor mite was making no headway, and was in danger of being seized by a fish, when I stepped knee-deep into the water and scooped him up. Carefully drying him with the end of my robe, I waded back to the shore and placed the shivering little bundle on the ground. Just a faint blur, and he vanished down the little burrow, no doubt thankful for his escape. Above me the ancient bird uttered a "Kruk" of derision, and creaked laboriously into the air, flapping noisily in the direction of Lhasa. In the direction of Lhasa? That reminded me, I should be going in the direction of the Potala. Over the Norbulinga wall monks were stooping, examining the washing drying upon the ground. Everything had to be carefully scrutinized before it could be picked up. Little brother beetle may be strolling across the clothing, and to roll up the garments would be to crush little brother, an act to make a Buddhist priest shudder and turn pale. Perhaps a little worm had taken shelter from the sun beneath a high lama's laundry, then little worm must be removed to safety so that his destiny may not be altered by man. All over the ground monks were stooping, peering, and gasping with relief as one little creature after another was safely delivered from certain death. Gradually the piles of washing grew as everything was heaped ready to be taken into the Potala. Small acolytes staggered along under newly washed burdens, some could not see over that which they were carrying. Then would come a sudden exclamation as a little fellow tripped and sent all the clothes flying to the dusty ground or even to the mud of the river bank. From high on the roof came the throb and boom of the conches and the blare of the great trumpets. Sounds which echoed and re-echoed from the distant mountains so that at times, when conditions were right, vibrations pulsed about one and beat at one's chest for minutes. Then suddenly, all would be still, quiet, so quiet that one could hear one's own heart beat. I left the shade of the friendly tree and made my halting way through a gap in the hedge. My legs were shaky. Some time previously I had sustained a grave burn to my left leg. It did not heal well, and then had two legs broken when a great gust of wind had lifted me from the Potala roof and thrown me down the mountainside. So I limped, and for a short time was exempt from doing my share of household duties. My joy at that was offset by having to study more that the debt may be set straight as I was informed. Today, wash day, I had been free to wander and rest in the Norbulinga. Not for mere return by way of the main entrance, with all the high lamas and abbots treading on one's heels. Not for me the hard, hard steps where I used to count 98, 99, 100, 101. I stood by the side of the road while lamas, monks, and pilgrims passed by. Then there was a lull and I limped across the road and ducked into the bushes. Pulling myself along the precipitous mountainside, I made my ascending way above the village of Sho and joined the side path between the courts of justice and the Potala. The way was rugged, but beautiful with its profusion of small rock plants. The air was cooling, and my battered legs were beginning to ache intolerably. I gathered my tattered old robe about me and sat upon a convenient rock so that I might regain my strength and my wind. Over in the direction of Lhasa I could see little sparkling fires. The traders were camping in the open, as Indians often did, rather than stay at one of the hostelries. Further to the right I could see the shining river as it left on its immense journey all the way to the Bay of Bengal. Urrah, said a deep bass voice, and a hard furry head butted me in the knees. Urrah, I answered amiably. A blur of movement and a big black cat stood on my legs and pushed his face into mine. Honorable Puss Puss, I said through thick fur. You are choking me with your attentions. Gently I put my hands on his shoulders and moved him back a little so that I could look at him. Big blue eyes, slightly crossed, stared back at me. His teeth were as white as the clouds above and his widespread ears were alert to the slightest sound. Honorable Puss Puss was an old and valued friend. Often we snuggled together beneath some sheltering bush and talked to each other of our fears, our disappointments, and all the hardships of our hard, hard life. Now he was showing his affection by knitting on me, opening and closing his big paws, while his purrs roared louder and louder. For a time we sat together, and then, together, we decided it was time to move. As I toiled ever upwards, stumbling from the pain in my damaged legs, Honorable Puss Puss raced ahead, tail stiffly erect. He would dive into some undergrowth and then, as I drew level, would spring out and cling playfully to my flapping robe. Now! Now! I exclaimed on one such occasion, this is no way for the leader of the Catjewel Guard to behave. In reply, he laid his ears back and rushed up the front of my robe and, reaching my shoulder, jumped sideways into a bush. It amused me to see our cats. We used them as guards, for a properly trained Siamese cat is fiercer than any dog. They were dressed, apparently asleep, by the side of the sacred objects. If pilgrims attempted to touch or steal, then these cats, always in pairs, would seize him and hold him by menacing his throat. They were fierce, yet I could do anything with them and, being telepathic, we could converse without difficulty. I reached the side entrance. Honorable Puss Puss was already there, energetically tearing great splinters off a wooden post by the side of the door. As I lifted the latch he pushed the door open with his strong head and vanished into the smoky gloom. I followed much more slowly. This was my temporary home. My leg injuries were such that I had been sent from Chakpori to the Potala. Now, as I entered the corridor, the familiar odors smelt home. The ever-present aroma of incense, the different perfumes according to the time and purpose for which it was being burned. The sour, rancid, and stinging smell from the yak butter which we used in our lamps, for heating small articles such as kettles, and which we used for sculpture during the colder days. The memory lingered on. No matter how hard we scrubbed, and we did not scrub too hard, the scent was always there, permeating everything. A less pleasant smell was that of yak dung which, dried, was used for heating the rooms of the aged and infirm. But now I stumbled on, moving down the corridor past the flickering butter lamps which made the gloomy corridors gloomier still. Another perfume was always present in all our masseries, a perfume so familiar that one did not notice it unless hunger had sharpened one's perceptions. Tsampa. The smell of roasted barley, the smell of Chinese brick tea, the smell of hot butter. Mix them and the result is the inevitable, the eternal tsampa. Some Tibetans have never tasted any other food than tsampa, they are born to the taste of it, and it is the last food they taste. It is food, drink, and consolation. It provides sustenance during the hardest manual labor, it provides food for the brain. But, it has ever been my belief, it starves sexual interest, and so Tibet has no difficulty in being a celibate state, a land of monks, and with a falling birth rate. Hunger had sharpened my perceptions, and so I was able to appreciate the aroma of roasted barley, hot butter, and Chinese brick tea. I walked wearily down the corridor and turned left when the scent was strongest. Here, at the great copper cauldrons, monk cooks were ladling roasted and ground barley into bubbling tea. One hacked off several pounds of yak butter and tossed it in, another upended a leather sack of salt which had been brought by tribesmen from the highland lakes. A fourth monk, with a 10-foot paddle, was stirring and swirling everything together. The cauldron bubbled and foamed and bits of twigs from the brick tea rose to the surface, to be swept off by the monk with the paddle. The burning yak dung beneath the cauldron gave off an acrid stench and clouds of black soot. The whole place was coated, and the black, sweat-streaked faces of the monk cooks could have been those of entities from some deep hell. Often the monk with the paddle would scrape floating butter from the cauldron and toss it on the fire. There would be a sizzle, a flare of flame, and a new stink. "Ah, Lobsang!" yelled a monk above the clatter and clamor. "Come for food again, eh? Help yourself, boy, help yourself." I took from inside my robe the little leather bag in which we monks kept day's supply of barley. Shaking the dust out, I filled it to capacity with freshly roasted, freshly ground barley. From the front of my robe I withdrew my bowl and looked at it carefully. It was a bit grubby, a bit caked. From the big bin against the far wall I took a handful of very fine sand and thoroughly scoured my bowl. It helped clean my hands as well. At last I was satisfied with its state. But another thing had to be done. My tea bag was empty, or rather, all it now contained was the small sticks, bits of sand, and other rubbish always found in the tea. This time I turned the bag inside out and picked free the debris. Returning the bag to its correct state, I took a hammer and knocked a suitable lump off the nearest brick of tea. Now it was my turn. Once again I took my bowl, my newly cleaned bowl, and held it out. A monk took a ladle and slapped my bowl brimming full of tsampa. Thankfully I retired to a corner, sat on a sack, and ate my fill. As I ate, I looked about me. The kitchen was full of the usual hangers-on, idle men who lounged about gossiping, telling the latest scandal, adding a bit to rumors just heard. "Yes, Lama Tenching is going to the rose fence. 'Tis said he had a quarrel with the Lord Abbot. My friend heard it all, he says. People have many strange notions about lamasseries or monasteries. It is often thought that monks spend the whole day in prayer, contemplation, or meditation, looking good and saying only good things. A lamasery is a place where, officially, men of religious intent congregate for the purpose of worship and contemplation that the spirit may be purified. Officially. Unofficially, a robe does not make a monk. In a community of several thousand there must be those who deal with household duties and repair and maintenance of the fabric. Others look after accounts, police the lower classes, teach, preach. Enough. Alamazri may be a large town with an exclusively male population. The workers will be the lowest class of monks and will have no interest in the religious aspect of the life, paying only lip service to it. Some monks have never been in a temple except to clean the floor. A large Lamasery will have a place of worship, schools, infirmary, stores, kitchens, hostels, prisons, and almost everything that will be found in a lay town. The main difference is that in a Lamasery everyone, everything, is male and, on the surface, everyone is devoted to religious instruction and action. Lamaseries have their earnest workers, and their well-meaning, bumbling drones. The larger Lamaseries are cities, or towns, with many buildings and parks spread over a wide area. Sometimes the whole community is encircled by a high wall. Other Lamaseries are small, possessing but 100 monks and all housed in one building. In some remote areas, a very small Lamasery may have no more than 10 members. So, they range from 10 to 10,000, the tall and the short, the fat and the thin, the good and the bad, the lazy and the energetic. The same as in some outside community, no worse, and often not much better except that Lamastic discipline may be almost military. It all depends on the abbot in charge. He may be a kind, considerate man, or he may be a tyrant. I stifled a yawn and wandered out into the corridor. A rustling in one of the store alcoves drew my attention. I was in time to see a black tail vanish between leather sacks of grain. The cats were guarding the grain and at the same time catching their mouse supper. On top of one sack I saw a contented-looking cat cleaning his whiskers and fairly smiling with satisfaction. The trumpets sounded, reverberating through the echoing corridors, and sounding again. I turned and made my way to the inner temple to the sound of many shuffling sandals and the slap of bare feet. Within, there was the deepening gloom of early evening, with the purple shadows stealing across the floor and lining the columns with ebony. The sides of the windows were edged with gold as the sun's fingers reached out and gave a last gentle caress to a home. Swirling clouds of incense drifted along and, when pierced by a shaft of sunlight, showed to be a myriad dust motes of living colors almost endowed with life. Monks and lamas, and humble acolytes, filed in and took their places upon the floor, each adding his own splash of color to be reflected upon the vibrant air. The gold robes of the Potala lamas, the saffron and red of others, the dark brown of monks, and the sun-bleached garments of those who habitually worked outside. All set in lines in the approved position. I, because my severe leg injuries prevented me from sitting as prescribed, was relegated to a back position where I was hidden by a smoke-wreathed column so that I should not destroy the pattern. I looked about me, seeing all the boys, the men, and the very old sages who were tending to their devotions each according to his understanding. I thought of my mother, the mother who had not even said goodbye to me when I had left home. How long ago that seemed! Exclamation mark to enter the Chakpori Lamasery. Men, all men. I knew only about men. What were women like? I knew that in some parts of Tibet, there were monasteries where monks and nuns lived together, married, and raised their families. The incense swirled on, the service droned on, and the dusk deepened into darkness barely relieved by the flickering butter lamps and the softly glowing incense. Men. Was it right for men to live alone, to have no association with women? What were women like, anyhow? Did they think the same as we? As far as I knew, they chattered only about fashion, hairstyle, and silly things like that. They looked awful frights, too, with all the stuff they put on their faces. The service ended, and I climbed painfully on shaky legs and stood with my back to the column so that I could not be toppled over in the first rush. Finally, I moved into the corridor and made my way to the dormitory. A chill wind was blowing through the open windows, blowing straight down from the Himalayas. The stars were shining bright and cold in the clear night air. From a window below me a quavering voice was reciting. Now this is the noble truth as to the origin of suffering. It is the craving thirst that causes the renewal of becomings. Tomorrow, I reminded myself, and for perhaps a few days after, we were going to have special lectures on Buddhism from one of the great Indian teachers. Our Buddhism, Lamaism, had departed from the strict orthodox lines of Indian Buddhism in much the same way as the Christian belief had various forms such as Quaker and Catholic. Now, though, the night hours were far advanced, and I turned away from the frosty window. About me acolytes were sleeping. Some snoring, a few tossed restlessly as they thought, maybe, of home as I had so recently been thinking. A few very hardy souls were trying to practice the correct lamaistic sleeping posture, sleeping upright in the lotus position. We had no beds, of course, nor mattresses. The floor was our table and our bed. I took off my robe, shivering naked in the chill night air, and then wrapped myself in the blanket which all Tibetan monks carry as a roll over one shoulder and caught at the waist. Cautiously lowering myself to the floor in case my treacherous legs betrayed me, I bundled my robe beneath my head as a pillow and dropped off to sleep. Chapter 2. You, boy, you, sit correctly, sit in the manner prescribed. The voice was like rolling thunder, then two heavy hands smote my ears, left, right. For a moment I thought all the temple gongs had clanged together. I saw more stars than were visible even during the clearest night. A hand grasped the collar of my robe, lifted me to my feet, and shook me like a duster being shaken from a window. "Answer me, boy, answer me," the angry voice shouted. But he gave me no opportunity to answer, just shaking me until my teeth rattled and my bowl fell out and rolled across the floor. My bag of barley fell and the thong became untied, loosing a shower of grain into the shocked earth. Satisfied at last, the fierce man threw me aside like a rag doll. Sudden silence descended and there was a tense air of expectancy. Cautiously I fingered my robe at the back of my left leg, a thin trickle of blood was oozing from the ruptured scar. Silence? I looked up. An abbot was standing in the doorway facing the fierce man. "The boy has been gravely injured," he said. "He has the inmost one's special permission to sit in the manner most comfortable. He has permission to answer a question without rising." The abbot walked over to me, looked at my blood-reddened fingers, and said, "The bleeding should soon stop. If it does not, visit the infirmarian." With that, he nodded to the fierce man and left the room. "I," said the fierce man, "have come specially from Mother India to tell you the truth of Buddhism. You in this country have broken away from our tenets and formed your own brand called Lamaism. I have come to tell you of the original truths." He glared at me as though I were his mortal enemy, then he told a boy to give me my bowl and my now empty barley bag. For some moments while this was being done, and while my spilled barley was being swept up, he paced around the room as though seeking another victim. He was a tall, lean man, very brown of skin and with a great beak of a nose. He wore the robes of an old Indian order, and he looked as though he despised us. The Indian teacher walked to the end of the room and mounted the small raised platform. Carefully he adjusted the lectern to his exact requirements. Fumbling in a leather bag which had stiff sides and square edges, he brought forth some remarkable sheets of paper. Thin paper, a hand span by two hands span, not at all like the long, thick sheets which we used. They were thin, translucent, and almost as pliable as cloth. His strange leather bag fascinated me. It was highly polished, and at the center of one narrow side it had a shiny piece of metal which clicked open when a button was touched. A piece of leather formed a highly convenient handle, and I determined that one day I would have just such a leather bag. The Indian rustled his papers, frowned severely at us, and told us the tale we had long known. I watched in profound interest the way in which the end of his nose wobbled as he spoke, and how his brow formed a sharp ridge as he squinted at the pages. The story he told us? The old familiar one. 2,500 years ago the people of India were disillusioned with their religion, the Hindu priests were degenerate, thinking only of earthly pleasures, thinking only of personal gain. The people whom they should have been helping were turning away from their old beliefs, turning to anything that would offer a scrap of hope. prophets and soothsayers roamed through the land with forecasts of doom and torture. Animal lovers decided that animals were better than humans, so they worshipped animals as gods.